Hello, and thanks for tuning in to Mind's Eye Radio. My name is Trevor, and I will be reading articles of politics, opinion, finance, business, science, and art from The Economist, from the 35th week of 2023. Cover story. America's astonishing economic growth goes up another gear. Will high bond yields be what finally takes it down? The Energizer Bunny. A pink mechanical hare that keeps banging its drum owing to long-lasting batteries will celebrate its 35th anniversary this October. As if to mark the momentous occasion, the American economy is doing its best imitation of the advertising icon. Despite umpteen predictions of a slowdown, it keeps going and going. Recent data suggest it may even be on track for annualized growth of nearly 6% in the third quarter, a pace it has hit only a few times since 2000. As has been the case repeatedly over the past year, a steady stream of better-than-expected data has left analysts scrambling to lift their forecasts. New orders for manufacturing firms reached their highest in 9 months in July. Retail sales were perky last month, too, with consumers splurging on everything from restaurant meals to online shopping and clothing to sporting goods. The construction industry has also been buoyant, supported by a rebound in home building. Underpinning all this is the labor market, which has remained hot, making it relatively easy for people to find work at decent wages. The total number of jobs in America has been growing faster than the working age population, helping to keep the unemployment rate at 3.5%, just shy of a five-decade low. The worry is that such strong growth, veering into overheating, will also beget a long-lasting inflation problem. Added up, America is on track for a GDP figure this quarter that may look more like a no-landing than the soft landing expected a short while ago. The Federal Reserve's branch in Atlanta uses a range of data points to estimate GDP growth in real time, a technique known as nowcasting rather than forecasting, because it assigns weights to already observed variables without factoring in expectations for future figures. On August 16th, its latest update, the model showed the economy may expand by 5.8% in the third quarter. That would be a shocker after more than a year of aggressive interest rate hikes by the Fed. Could growth really be that strong? The nowcast almost certainly exaggerates the economy's vigor. It is normally off by about 2 percentage points at this point in the quarterly cycle. One factor this time is likely to be inventories. When firms make sales from their stocks rather than by producing new goods, this drawdown counts as a subtraction from GDP. A recent gap between rising retail sales and declining wholesale transactions suggests that such a drawdown is now taking place and will weigh on growth, according to Andrew Hunter of Capital Economics, a consultancy. Still, even if somewhat exaggerated, the Atlanta's Fed's nowcast is almost always directionally correct. The inference is clear. America's economy is not just holding up, but steaming ahead. Recent months have offered some respite on the inflation front. Core prices, which strip out volatile food and energy costs, have risen at their slowest pace in more than 2 years. But if the economy continues to heat up, inflation may well stage a rebound. Andrew Hollenhorst of Citigroup, a bank, warns that shortages of both workers and housing risk a significant re-acceleration of prices next year. Where once optimists thought that inflation might be transitory, now pessimists fear that disinflation will be fleeting. That would scupper hopes for a pivot to monetary loosening by the Fed. The strength of the American economy may also add to financial strains. It is the principal factor explaining why investors have sold off government bonds since May. Yields, which move inversely to prices, have risen by about 1 percentage point during that time, with long-term Treasury yields climbing to 16-year highs. This has prompted a debate about whether America's neutral short-term interest rate, where the Fed would set rates to neither stifle nor stimulate growth, has drifted up. Bill Dudley, a former Fed official, has argued that in the long run, America may require higher rates to balance the need for more borrowing, implied by higher government deficits, and a smaller funding pool, as retirees spend their savings. A gathering of central bankers in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, taking place after we go to press, was expected to discuss such issues. Wall Street is now convinced that in the short run, the Fed will need to keep rates higher than expected too. A few months ago, most were pricing in rapid rate cuts starting in September. Now, most think the Fed will wait until May and will move tepidly. Given the economy's continuous outperformance, pricing in higher rates further into the future seems prudent. Higher yields are contributing to an increase in funding costs for financial institutions, which are a headache for smaller lenders in particular. Moody's and S&P, two credit rating agencies, downgraded a spate of banks this month, a reminder of the continued fragility of the financial sector. Higher borrowing costs are also starting to bite for consumers. Delinquencies on credit cards and car loans have started to increase sharply. Finally, higher rates are clouding the outlook for housing. Like the wider economy, the market has been most notable for its resilience to date. But mortgage rates have jumped over the past couple of months and hit 7.5% this week, their highest since 2001. This is already having a dampening effect on existing home sales, which could spread to home building and construction more generally. The lesson of recent history is that the American economy inevitably blows through such problems. Nothing lasts forever, though. The higher yields rise, the greater the challenge. In the advertisements, the Energizer Bunny's batteries never fade. In real life, even the strongest batteries are drained eventually, or unceremoniously yanked out. Section 1. America's pandemic savings are running out. What will that mean for the economy? For the past year, the success of America's economy has rested on three pillars: a healthy labor market, falling inflation, and robust spending fueled by savings accumulated during the pandemic. This last pillar may be starting to give way. Research by Hamza Abdulrahman and Luis Oliveira of the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco suggests that Americans have burned through more than 90% of the excess savings they amassed in 2020 and 2021. What little remains, the economists estimate, is likely to be gone by the end of September. During the pandemic, stimulus checks and other government support boosted personal incomes by more than $1 trillion, while lockdown restrictions reduced Americans' spending by another $1 trillion. As a result, monthly personal savings swelled from around 9% of income in 2019 to more than 30% in the spring of 2020, and 20% during the Alpha and Delta waves of the pandemic the next year. All told, Americans accumulated excess savings, the amount above what would be expected from pre-pandemic trends, of around $2.1 trillion. But data from the Bureau of Economic Analysis, a government agency, show that by June 2022, America's personal savings rate had plummeted to just 2.7%, although the rate has ticked up slightly since then. In June, households squirreled away 4.3% of their incomes. It remains well below pre-pandemic levels. There are signs that a growing number of households are financially stretched. Data from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York show that credit card debt now stands at more than $1 trillion, or around 4% of annual income, up 16% from a year ago. Late payments on credit card and auto loan debt are also rising, albeit from a low base. But when Americans' pandemic savings will run out is a subject of debate. Although the forecast by Messrs. Abdulrahman and Oliveira shows that excess savings could be depleted by the end of next month, economists at the Federal Reserve Board estimate that they were already exhausted in the first quarter of this year. By contrast, analysts at Goldman Sachs, a bank, reckon that there is little reason to think that households will ever get through their excess savings completely. The discrepancy can be explained by differing methodologies and assumptions about the pre-pandemic trend. What is not in question is that Americans have spent down their cash reserves. Messrs. Abdulrahman and Oliveira find that this has happened faster than after previous recessions, and the drawdown has taken place across all income groups. At the same time, the stockpile of excess savings may matter less than it used to. For the first time in a few years, nominal wage increases for most Americans have started eclipsing the rate of inflation. That means that, at last, they are enjoying real income growth, giving them greater latitude to fund their spending from earnings rather than savings. The question is whether that will be enough to sustain America's consumer-led recovery. Section 2. America's corporate giants are getting harder to topple. Incumbents from Walmart to General Motors are fighting back against disruptors. Attend any business conference or open any management book, and an encounter with some variation of the same message is almost guaranteed. The pace of change in business is accelerating, and no one is safe from disruption. Recent breakthroughs in artificial intelligence have left many corporate Goliaths nervously anticipating David's sling, fearing that they might meet the same fate as firms such as Kodak and Blockbuster, two giants that were felled by the digital revolution. The Innovator's Dilemma, a seminal book written in 1997 by Clayton Christensen, a management guru, observed that incumbents hesitate to pursue radical innovations that would make their products or services cheaper or more convenient, for fear of denting the profitability of their existing businesses. In the midst of technological upheaval, that creates an opening for upstarts unencumbered by such considerations. Yet the reality is that America Incorporated has experienced surprisingly little competitive disruption during the age of the Internet. Incumbents appear to have become more secure, not less, and there is good reason to believe that they will remain atop their perches. Consider the Fortune 500, America's largest companies by revenue, ranging from Walmart to Wells Fargo. Accounting for roughly a fifth of employment, half of sales and two-thirds of profits, they form the backbone of corporate America. The Economist has examined the age of each firm, taking into account the mergers and spin-offs that paint an artificially youthful picture of the group. We found that only 52 of the 500 were born after 1990, our yardstick for the Internet era. That includes Alphabet, Amazon, and Meta, but misses Apple and Microsoft, middle-aged tech titans. Merely 7 of the 500 were created after Apple unveiled the first iPhone in 2007, while 280 predate America's entry into the Second World War. In fact, the rate at which new corporate behemoths arise has been slowing. In 1990, just 66 firms in the Fortune 500 were 30 years old or younger, and since then the average has crept up from 75 to 90. One explanation is that the digital revolution has not been all that revolutionary in some parts of the economy, notes Julian Birkinshaw of the London Business School. Communications, entertainment, and shopping have been turned on their heads, but extracting oil from the ground or sending electricity down wires look mostly the same. High-profile flops like WeWork, a much-hyped office-sharing firm now at risk of collapse, and Katerra, a failed one-time unicorn that tried to redefine the construction business by using prefabricated building components and fewer middlemen, have discouraged others from trying to disrupt their respective industries. Another reason is that inertia has slowed the pace of competitive upheaval in many industries, buying time for incumbents to adapt to digital technologies. Although 65% of Americans now bank online, nearly all the banks they use are ancient. The average age of those in the Fortune 500, including JPMorgan Chase and Bank of America, is 138. Fewer than 10% of Americans switched banks last year, according to Kearney, a consultancy. That stickiness has made it difficult for would-be disruptors to build scale before incumbents imitate their innovations. A labyrinthine regulatory system that favors big institutions with well-staffed compliance departments also contributes. The insurance industry, also dominated by geriatric giants like AIG and MetLife, is much the same. The pattern is not unique to financial services. Walmart, America's mightiest retailer, almost missed the rise of e-commerce. David Glass, its chief executive in the 1990s, predicted that online sales would never exceed those of its single largest retail warehouse, according to a recently published book, Winner Sells All, by Jason Del Rey, a journalist. Nonetheless, Walmart's financial heft and enormous customer base gave it the chance to change course later. Only Amazon now sells more online in America. The recent growth of electric vehicles from Ford and General Motors, America's two largest car makers, offers another example. Their bulky balance sheets have allowed them to pour vast amounts of money into reinventing their businesses at a time when raising capital is becoming more difficult for newcomers. A third explanation for the endurance of America's incumbents is that their scale creates a momentum of its own around innovation. Joseph Schumpeter, the economist who coined the phrase creative destruction, first argued that economic progress was propelled mostly by new entrants, noting in The Theory of Economic Development, a book published in 1911, that in general is not the owner of stagecoaches who build railways. By the time Schumpeter published Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy, his magnum opus of 1942, he had changed his mind. It was, in fact, large firms, monopolies even, that drove innovation, thanks to their ability to splash cash on research and development, and quickly monetize breakthroughs through existing customers and operations, spurred on by an ever-present fear of being toppled. America's tech titans offer the quintessential illustration. Alphabet, Amazon, Apple, Meta, and Microsoft invested a combined $200 billion in R&D last year, equivalent to 80% of their combined profits and 30% of all R&D spending by listed American firms. Less obvious examples abound too. John Deere, America's largest agricultural equipment business, founded in 1837, leads the way on recent innovations like driverless tractors and clever sprayers that use machine learning to spot and target weeds. Its ambition is to make farming fully autonomous by 2030, says Deanna Kovar, an executive at the firm. It has been snatching laid-off techies from Silicon Valley and now employs more software engineers than mechanical ones. Incumbents and newcomers also often play complementary roles in innovation. William Baumol, an economist, wrote in 2002 of a David and Goliath symbiosis in which radical breakthroughs are generated by independent innovators and then enhanced by established firms. A paper in 2020 by Annette Becker of the Technical University of Munich and co-authors split the R&D spending of a sample of firms into its two components, the more exploratory research and the more commercially oriented development, and found that the relative weight of research declined with firm size. Likewise, a 2018 paper by Ufuk Aksigit of the University of Chicago and William Kerr of Harvard Business School found that the patents generated by large firms were less radical and more focused on incremental improvements to existing products and processes. That division of labor may help explain why many startups are bought by established firms. John Deere's acquisition in 2017 of Blue River, a startup, gave it the technology behind its clever weed sprayer, which it was then able to sell through its vast network of distributors. Over the past decade, 74% of venture capital exits in America were via such acquisitions, according to PitchBook, a data provider. That is up from next to none in the 1980s, leading to warnings of a plague of killer acquisitions, with big firms eating their potential future rivals. Such nefarious cases do occur, but are rare. A study in 2021 by Colleen Cunningham, then at the London Business School, and co-authors, found that 5-7% of acquisitions by pharmaceutical companies, which rely heavily on startups to top up drug pipelines, looked suspect. Most of the time, folding into an established giant is simply the most efficient way for an innovative new firm to bring its breakthroughs to the world. A final explanation for the lack of competitive disruption in corporate America relates to demographics. Young firms are generally built by young people, notes John Van Reenen of the London School of Economics. Between 1980 and 2020, the share of the American population aged between 20 and 35 fell from 26% to 20%. The rate of new business formation fell from 12% to 8% over the same period. In a 2019 study comparing variations in population growth and new business formation across states in America, Fatih Karanan of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and co-authors concluded that falling population growth accounted for 60% of the decline in the business entry rate over the past four decades. Application rates to start new businesses in America surged in late 2020 after plummeting in the early months of the COVID-19 pandemic, and have since remained well above pre-pandemic levels. That entrepreneurial burst has largely focused on hospitality and retailing, which were hammered by the pandemic, and over time may peak, especially as household savings, puffed up by the pandemic, dwindle. Optimists will hope that the recent flurry of investment in AI startups can sustain the momentum. Even if it does, the corporate giants of the past may well remain on top. Section 3. Do abortion-related benefits help American firms recruit? A new paper shows that they attract some potential employees, but may turn off others. 6 months ago, Tommy Tuberville, a football coach-turned-senator from Alabama, embarked on a crusade against the Pentagon. Mr. Tuberville, a member of the Senate's Armed Services Committee, which approves military appointments, has blocked more than 300 senior-level promotions since February. Officials warn that the holdup is compromising American security. His qualm? A federal policy that pays for service women based in conservative states to travel elsewhere to get an abortion. The debate playing out in Congress is also happening in the C-suites of American companies. After the Supreme Court scrapped Roe v. Wade last year, making states the new arbiters of abortion policy, some employers offered new benefits to women who want abortions. Amazon, Google, Lyft, and Starbucks, along with many other firms, said they would pay for employees' abortion-related travel. CEOs portrayed their abortion-friendly policies as public-spirited, but many no doubt are also hoping that they will help retain and recruit talented workers. A new working paper published by the Institute of Labor Economics, or the IZA, a German think tank, presents intriguing early evidence on whether that bet is paying off. The researchers identified 76 firms that offered cash to enable employees to travel out of state to get one or more abortions. Those firms are willing to give an employee a total of $4,500 on average, equivalent to around 5% of the average salary. The researchers found that recruitment ads from firms that touted the benefit that were posted on Indeed, a popular online job board, received 8% more clicks than did ads from similar companies that had not changed their policy. That is not a small effect. It is equivalent to the amount of increased interest a vacancy would get from raising the posted wage by 12%. The rise in interest was biggest in Democratic-leaning states and for advertisements for jobs in female-dominated professions in states with abortion bans. But the travel offer appears to have a big downside for firms. Job satisfaction at companies that introduced it fell by 8%, as measured by ratings on Glassdoor, a review website. Workers in male-dominated jobs were particularly unenthusiastic. Reviews containing the word woke rose by 325%. Workers who chose not to reveal their locations, perhaps out of fear of retaliation, were most likely to report steep declines in their job satisfaction. It may be that the bad online reviews reflect the opinions of just a vocal minority of workers, but companies were worried enough to take action to allay the concerns that some potential employees might have. The researchers found that, after making the travel benefit offer, the 76 companies raised their salary offers in job ads by 4.2% more than those that did not. At firms where employee morale fell by the most, advertised salaries increased by even more. Taking into account other labor market conditions, such as industry-wide worker shortages and rising company profits, the study found that it was specifically the announcement of the abortion benefits that sparked the increase. It is unclear whether abortion-related benefits will bring a net financial gain or loss to firms. Attracting a larger candidate pool, and so making it easier to hire better people, may offset the costs of offering new benefits and raising salaries. But unhappy workers, whether many or few, cause problems for their bosses. After all, it seems to take only one man from Alabama to cause mayhem in the upper echelons of America's armed forces. Section 4. Russians have immigrated in huge numbers since the war in Ukraine. The exodus adds to Vladimir Putin's economic woes. The first exodus came at the start of the war. Up to 300,000 Russians fled the country in the first few months of their president's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. The second wave set off when Vladimir Putin announced a partial mobilization in September, and desperate young men rushed to border crossings to avoid the draft. Establishing the precise scale of emigration prompted by the war is tricky. The Kremlin has, unsurprisingly, not published data on the matter, and independent estimates have varied from 500,000 to 1 million. But a new analysis has narrowed that range. Regarding Russia, an analysis and policy network has examined various estimates and available data from countries that have accepted large numbers of Russian emigres. They found that between 817,000 and 522,000 people have left Russia since February 2022. The largest recipient countries were Kazakhstan and Serbia, each with 150,000 emigrants. But Russians have moved all over the world, including between 30,000 and 40,000 who went to America, according to the estimates. There are uncertainties about the data. Russians may travel through several transit countries before settling. Others return home having struggled to establish a life abroad, often citing difficulties securing work. Some returnees suggest they will try to emigrate again once their financial circumstances allow it. Emigration for Mr. Putin's Russia is not new. In the first 19 years of his rule, 1.6 to 2 million people left the country, though the rate has been declining since the turbulent decade after 1989. The rate increased significantly around 2012, when Mr. Putin returned to the Russian presidency in an election marked by fraud and protests. Yet the invasion of Ukraine has caused the single largest exodus prompted by political upheaval since the 1920s. Also significant is the profile of those who are able to move. In general, Russia's wartime emigres have relatively high levels of income, social capital, and education. That is bad news for Russia, both economically and socially. Regarding Russia, reckons that the wartime emigrants account for roughly 1% of Russia's workforce, exacerbating an acute labor shortage. The Gaidar Institute, a think tank in Moscow, said that 35% of manufacturing businesses did not have enough workers in April, the highest figure since 1996. Shortages of specialists are especially severe. According to one Kremlin official, at least 100,000 IT professionals left the country in 2022. With no vision for the future aside from international isolation and war, the Kremlin will struggle to stem the tide. Section 5. Corals are bleaching and dying earlier in the year than ever before. Scientists are evacuating corals off the coast of Florida to save them. On July 24th, a buoy in the Manatee Bay off Florida's southern tip measured a record-breaking sea surface temperature of more than 101 degrees Fahrenheit. Normally, you'd need to take a bath to immerse yourself in water of that temperature. Beachgoers may not mind the warm waters now present off the coast of Florida and in many other places, but they are terrible for marine wildlife. Many underwater creatures will move to colder waters. For plants and animals that can move less freely, including corals, the high ocean temperatures are life-threatening. According to America's National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, which monitors coral heat stress by satellite, parts of the ocean off the coast of Florida are experiencing the worst heat stress since records began in 1985. In the Florida Keys, water temperatures have risen to dangerous levels for corals much earlier than in previous years, too. NOAA has issued its highest alert level, signaling that strong bleaching events are likely for large parts of the Caribbean. The longer corals are in hot waters, the more likely they are to bleach and eventually to die. Bleaching events have already occurred this year off the coast of Central American countries, including El Salvador and Panama. Corals are essential to marine life and support jobs. They provide breeding grounds, food, or shelter to about a quarter of all marine species at some point in their lives, even though they cover less than 1% of the ocean floor. Reefs also break waves and protect shores from erosion. The fish they attract provide livelihoods to fishermen. Coral-related tourism generates about $36 billion of spending each year. As the climate warms, bleaching events are becoming more common and last longer. Reefs have already shrunk by half since 1957. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, a UN body, projects that they will decline by a further 70-90%, with 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming above pre-industrial levels. More than 99% could be lost in a scenario of 2 degrees Celsius of global warming. This year, El Niño, a natural climate phenomenon that temporarily warms the planet, will increase the risk to coral reefs. Strong El Niños can lead to severe marine heat waves and bleach reefs across the tropics. The last time this happened was between 2014 and 2017. NOAA forecasts that the marine heat wave will spread in September and October this year, by which time 50% of the world's oceans could be experiencing extreme heat, up from 44% now. Scientists and conservationists are racing to help save them. Divers from the Coral Restoration Foundation, a charity that works with NOAA and aims to preserve Florida's coral reefs, have evacuated 2,500 corals to tanks on land. This effort may save some endangered species, but it is just a tiny fraction of the total. Conservation groups in Florida are also considering proposals to save coral reef nurseries, where corals are grown on land and at sea to restock wild reefs by temporarily shading them. The evacuated corals will eventually return to their waters. But if the average ocean temperature continues to rise as a result of climate change, they may not be safe for long. Section 6. Scientists want to fix tooth decay with stem cells. Regrowing natural enamel would be better than a filling. The human body is a marvelous thing, but like anything built by evolution, it has plenty of flaws. Consider teeth. Whereas sharks grow new teeth throughout their lives, adult humans get one set, which must last 60 years or more. That is tricky. A combination of poverty, sugar-rich diets, and poor hygiene means 2.5 billion people around the world suffer from tooth decay, in which acid produced by mouth-dwelling bacteria eats away at the hard enamel that coats the outside of a tooth. That can open the door to painful infections, which cause further damage. Once decay has set in, all a dentist can do is fill the gap with an artificial plug, a filling. But in a paper published in Cell, Hanel Ruhola Baker, a stem cell biologist at the University of Washington, and her colleagues offer a possible alternative. Stem cells are those that have the capacity to turn themselves into any other type of cell in the body. It may soon be possible, the researchers argue, to use those protein cells to regrow a tooth's enamel naturally. The first step was to work out exactly how enamel is produced. That is tricky because enamel-making cells, known as ameloblasts, disappear soon after a person's adult teeth have finished growing. To get round that problem, the researchers turned to samples of tissue from human fetuses that had been aborted, either medically or naturally. Such tissues contain plenty of functioning ameloblasts. The researchers then checked to see which genes were especially active in the enamel-producing cells. Tooth enamel is made mostly of calcium phosphate, and genes that code for proteins designed to bind to calcium were particularly busy. They also assessed another type of cell called odontoblasts. These express genes that produce dentin, another type of hard tissue that lies beneath the outer enamel. Armed with that information, Dr. Rahola Baker and her colleagues next checked to see whether the stem cells could be persuaded to transform into ameloblasts. The team devised a cocktail of drugs designed to activate the genes that they knew were expressed in functioning ameloblasts. That did the trick, with the engineered ameloblasts churning out the same proteins as the natural sort. A different cocktail pushed the stem cells to become odontoblasts instead. Culturing the cells together produced what researchers called an organoid, a glob of tissue in a petri dish which mimics a biological organ. The organoids happily churned out the chemical components of enamel. Having both cell types seemed to be crucial. When odontoblasts were present alongside ameloblasts, genes coding for enamel proteins were more strongly expressed than with ameloblasts alone. For now, the work is more a proof of concept than a prototype of an imminent medical treatment. The next step, says Dr. Rahola Baker, is to try to boost enamel production even further, with a view to eventually beginning clinical trials. The hope is that, one day, medical versions of the team's organoids could be used as biological implants to regenerate a patient's decayed teeth. Stem cell-based therapies are not the only ones heading to clinical trials. Another class of treatments is known as biomimetic repair. This involves rebuilding the tooth crown using synthetic proteins, which are similar but not quite identical to human enamel. Unlike stem cell treatments, the proteins could be included in toothpaste, mouthwash, and even cough drops. But synthetic formulations can be less durable than human enamel. It will take time for either technology to arrive in the clinic. One question is just how durable the enamel made by stem cell-derived ameloblasts proves to be. Another is how best to deliver the stem cells to a patient's mouth. But these findings are promising. As any dentist will tell you, prevention is better than cure. But a better cure would be welcome nonetheless. Section 7. How dangerous is TRANK, the new drug sweeping America? It comes with grim side effects, and there is no antidote. In the early 2010s, reports emerged of a nightmarish drug appearing in Russia and Eastern Europe. Crocodile, a cheap substitute for heroin that was concocted in kitchen laboratories, left users with scaly skin and rotting wounds. Now, a similarly damaging drug, a fentanyl mix known as Trank Dope, has arrived in America. Deaths associated with it have almost quadrupled since 2019, rising as a share of fentanyl-related deaths from 3% in January that year to 11% in June 2022. Last month, the White House announced a plan to stop its spread. How worrying is Trank Dope? Trank Dope combines fentanyl, a synthetic opioid drug, with xylazine, or Trank, a strong non-opioid tranquilizer used to sedate horses, deer, and other large animals. It was first detected by drug authorities in the early 2000s in Puerto Rico and, in the years since, circulated there and in limited areas within the American Northeast, such as Philadelphia. But the drug has now been detected in nearly every state in the country and, according to the Drug Enforcement Administration, is probably being mixed by local dealers. Xylazine can be bought for as little as $6 per kilogram on Chinese websites, so illicit drug suppliers can maximize their profits by using it to bulk up their more expensive fentanyl, supplied mostly by Mexican drug cartels. Many end users will not know whether they are buying fentanyl or Trank Dope, though it is becoming increasingly risky to assume that the former has not been cut with xylazine. In March, the DEA said that almost a quarter of American fentanyl powder contained it. In 2021, the proportion was above 90% in Philadelphia. That is cause for concern. Though chemically different from crocodile, Trank affects the body in a similar way. It causes deep, necrotic wounds, in which skin and muscle simply rot away. Such wounds can easily become infected. Ultimately, limbs might need to be amputated. Large doses can cause loss of consciousness, which makes the drug taker an easy target for assault or robbery. Perhaps more worrying still, naloxone, the emergency treatment for a fentanyl overdose, is ineffective against non-opioids like xylazine. Naloxone acts on opioid receptors in the brain to reverse the effects of drugs like fentanyl, in particular suppressed breathing. But for xylazine, no such antidotes are approved for humans. That means someone who has overdosed on trank dope might need more than naloxone to survive, such as extra oxygen and breathing support. Still, addiction medics say that synthetic opioids remain their chief concern. They kill more and more Americans every year, claiming about 70,000 lives in 2021. In comparison, about 43,000 people died in car crashes that year. Yet those taking trank dope are at greater risk of a fatal overdose. At a minimum, its growing presence complicates America's already difficult battle against overdose deaths and risks making drug users even more vulnerable. Authorities seem to be taking the challenge seriously. In February, the Food and Drug Administration announced that it would start checking imported xylazine, which can be legally bought for veterinary use, and detain suspicious shipments. The Biden administration's national plan aims to reduce deaths from trank dope by 15% in at least 3 or 4 American census areas by 2025. They hope to do this by standardizing and increasing trank testing, disrupting the illicit trade, potentially through new regulations on xylazine, and finding xylazine antidotes. Nevertheless, the DEA suspects that trank will continue to spread. In Puerto Rico, the drug is sought out for its extended high. According to some reports, the same is now happening in Philadelphia. If more drug users start to seek out trank, America could have an even grimmer problem on its hands. Section 8. How America's Right Turned Rich Men North of Richmond into a Hit. Oliver Anthony's song blames urban elites for the woes of working-class Americans. He sports a red beard fit for a Viking, prays before he performs, and strums his guitar with his 3 hounds slumped by his boots. Oliver Anthony is an unlikely star. And yet his song, Rich Men North of Richmond, released on August 11th, is crowning the charts, having racked up more than 34 million streams on YouTube. He is the first musician to debut in the number one slot on the Billboard Hot 100 without having had another song in the charts before. How did an unsigned, unknown artist become the minstrel of the moment? The song's substance helps explain its success. With the nostalgic twang of Appalachian folk, the bearded bard is singing of America's struggles. When Mr. Anthony laments, "Your dollar ain't shit, and it's taxed to no end," and repeats the chorus, "It's a damn shame what the world's gotten to for people like me and people like you," he is speaking directly to the anger millions of listeners feel as they struggle with inflation, high living costs, and disillusionment with Washington. Mr. Anthony is also parroting frequent complaints heard from populists on the American right, crooning that obese people use welfare funds to buy fudge and that northern elites travel to private islands to abuse minors, a reference to Jeffrey Epstein and his ties to Democratic politicians. Conservative pundits, including Joe Rogan, a podcast host, and Carrie Lake, an ally of Donald Trump who ran unsuccessfully for office in Arizona, praised Mr. Anthony's authenticity online to their social media followers. These endorsements helped rich men go viral, says Jada Watson, who studies country music. For years, America's political divisions have played out on cable news. Now they are shifting to the music charts. In May, Jason Aldean, a country singer, released "Try That in a Small Town," a warning to urban protesters. Critics deemed the music video racist. Nikki Haley, a Republican presidential hopeful, added it to her campaign playlist, and the row drove the song to number one in early August. Mr. Anthony maintains that he is centrist. He claims to have rejected a proposed $8 million record deal, saying that he does not want to buy a private jet and tour buses, play shows at stadiums, or be in the spotlight. But that will not stop conservative voters and right-wing politicians using his music as their theme song. Section 9. AI could make it less necessary to learn foreign languages. That is good news for travelers, bad news for soulful connection. On holiday, many will find themselves in places where they do not speak the language. Once upon a time, they might have carried a phrasebook. The rise of English has made that less necessary, but most people, at least 7 of the world's 8 billion, still do not speak English. That leaves options like pantomime, a willingness to be surprised by what arrives at dinner, or, increasingly, technology. More and more people are using simple, free tools not only to decode text, but also to speak. With these apps' conversation mode, you talk into a phone and a spoken translation is heard moments later. The app can also listen for another language and produce a translation in yours. You may still get a surprise or two. Google Translate may be the best-known name in machine translation, but it often blunders. Take, "My wife is gluten-free," the kind of thing you might say at a restaurant abroad. In French or Italian, Google Translate renders this as, "My wife is without gluten," true to the words rather than the meaning. DeepL, Arrival, does better, offering various options, most of them along the correct lines. The best tool may not be a translation app at all. Though not marketed for the purpose, ChatGPT, a generative AI system that churns out prose according to users' prompts, is multilingual. Rather than entering an exact text to translate, users can tell ChatGPT to write a message in Spanish to a waiter that my wife and I would like the tasting menu, but that she is gluten-free, so we would like substitutions for anything that has gluten. And out pops a perfect paragraph, including the way Spanish speakers actually say, "My wife is gluten-free." Mi esposa es celíaca. It is a paraphrase rather than a translation, more like having a native-speaking dinner companion than an automated interpreter. Travel has long been a motivator for study, unless people start to feel AI tools offer a good enough service. Some are concerned that apps are turning language acquisition into a dwindling pursuit. Douglas Hofstadter, a polyglot and polymath writer, has argued that something profound will vanish when people talk through machines. He describes giving a halting, difficult speech in Mandarin, which required a lot of work but offered a sense of accomplishment at the end. Who would boast of taking a helicopter to the top of Mount Everest? Others are less worried. Most people do not move abroad or have the kind of sustained contact with a foreign culture that requires them to put in the work to become fluent. Nor do most people learn languages for the purpose of humanizing themselves or training their brains. On their holiday, they just want a beer and the spaghetti carbonara without incident, and sometimes without gluten. As AI translation becomes an even more popular labor-saving tool, people will split into two groups. There will be those who want to stretch their minds, immerse themselves in other cultures, or force their thinking into new pathways. This lot will still take on language study, often aided by technology. Others will look at learning a new language with a mix of admiration and puzzlement, as they might with extreme endurance sports. Good for you if that's your thing, but a bit painful for my taste. This is largely an Anglophone problem, since native English speakers miss out on the benefits of language learning most acutely. In many countries, including Britain and America, schools and universities' foreign language departments have been closing. The British government recently devoted a modest fund to trying to get more secondary school pupils to study foreign languages. In the rest of the rich world, there is one thriving language that people still study, English. And in poorer countries, many people are multilingual as a matter of course. Africans and Indians learn languages because they are surrounded by them. But a focus on the learner alone misses the fundamentally social nature of language. It is a bit like analyzing the benefits of close relationships to heart health, but overlooking the inherent value of those bonds themselves. When you try to ask directions in broken Japanese or mangle a joke in halting German, you are making direct contact with someone. And when you speak a language well enough to tell a story with perfect timing or put subtle shading on an argument, that connection is more profound still. The best relationships do not require an intermediary. Section 10. Calls for actors' identities to match their roles have gone too far. How to weigh authenticity in casting versus the privileges of art. Posterity holds much crueler fates for politicians than to be reincarnated as Helen Mirren. Such is Golda Meir's lot in Golda, which dramatizes the trials of Israel's only female prime minister during the Yom Kippur War of 1973, ignited by a surprise attack from Egypt and Syria. Miss Mirren movingly portrays a lone woman in a coterie of military men, a chain-smoking lymphoma sufferer whose country is threatened with extinction. The film is out in America on August 25th. Before its release, though, it has been criticized by some for casting a Gentile as a Jewish luminary, as have Oppenheimer and Maestro, an upcoming biopic of Leonard Bernstein starring Bradley Cooper in a controversial prosthetic nose. Those concerns are part of a wider ruckus over authenticity in casting, or who can play whom. As with many cultural rows, a reasonable course is discernible amid the shouting. These days, hardly anyone thinks every actor is eligible for absolutely any part. The practice of white actors donning makeup for black roles is now unconscionable, not least because of its roots in the ignoble tradition of blackface minstrelsy. Originating in the 1830s and popular for much of the 20th century, minstrelsy demeaned black people and mocked their aspirations. Its link to oppression is captured in the name of an early blackface persona, Jim Crow. Similar forms of racial mimicry are no-nos too. Today's strife tends to involve other strictures, which are proliferating. Some in showbiz and beyond think depictions of many marginalized groups should be reserved for members of them. Straight performers should not take gay parts. Only trans actors should play trans roles, and only deaf actors, deaf ones. Artists with dwarfism have decried Hugh Grant's appearance as an Oompa Loompa in a forthcoming Willy Wonka film. Brendan Fraser's recent turn as the obese protagonist of The Whale, for which he wore a fat suit and won an Oscar, irked some plus-sized observers. Part of the grievance is that deaf actors, say, or those with dwarfism, are routinely overlooked by casting directors and resent missing out on the rare work that mirrors their experience. But the objections involve justice as well as jobs. As with blackface, runs the argument, casting non-disabled actors as disabled characters or Gentiles as Jews can lead to caricature and distortion, and those can cause misconceptions and prejudice, which seep from stage and screen into the real world. This argument is winning. If it seems an age since Laurence Olivier wore dark makeup to play Othello in 1965, even Eddie Redmayne's trans role in The Danish Girl in 2015 now seems antiquated. Mr. Redmayne has since said taking that part was a mistake, one of several stars and directors to express regret for bygone violations of the new orthodoxy. Orthodoxies, however, can calcify into dogma, and pendulums swing too far. Dissenting voices worry, rightly, that the promise and privileges of art are being willfully renounced. Always and only viewing roles in terms of groups and categories is impractical. In the case of a gay Irish part, for instance, which is more essential, a gay actor or an Irish one? It is simplistic, as Golda shows. The crux of Miss Mirren's character is that she must make decisions over soldiers' lives and deaths, a burden few people of any race or nation have carried, none of them actors. Above all, rigid identity matching is soulless. Rounded characters, like people, are more than the sum of their labels. Acting can illuminate prejudices and difference. Yet, at its finest, it surmounts them in leaps of imagination and empathy. Filmmakers have the right to cast whomever they like. Still, a fair and politic approach is for roles to go to the best qualified performers, on criteria that include background alongside other factors. Those from underrepresented groups should be considered and get a better shot than in the past. But if there are sound artistic reasons, such as talent or screen chemistry, someone else may be cast. The lame king in Richard III need not always be played by a disabled actor, but disabled actors should get a crack at him, as Arthur Hughes did last year at the Royal Shakespeare Theatre. In other words, judge the output, not the inputs, and judge it first as art. This bargain over casting has a final condition for actors and directors. Do your research on unfamiliar lives, do your best, then be prepared for criticism. Activists should not have an audition room veto, but like everyone, they are entitled to an opinion. Well, that's all the time I have for today, but thank you again for tuning in to Mind's Eye Radio. You've been listening to this week's edition of The Economist. This is Trevor, wishing you a good rest of your day.